At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Okay, here's what we're going to do. The noise of the news cycle on economics is ridiculous between tariffs and cost of living and inflation and everything else. We're going to get back to basics. We're going to talk some plain Jane, so easy even I can understand it, economic principles in a practical way. And we're going to get a guy with a PhD to explain it to us, our old friend Stephen Popick. That's Dr. Stephen Popick to you, but his friends just call him Dr. Stephen Popick. How are you, sir?
My friends just call me Steve, and I've survived the first 6 months of this change, and I'm happy to say that I'm still employed and doing a good job for the American people.
He is an economist, but he has a diverse background, including writing at ordinary-times.com occasionally. You need to get back to that when you get time, my friend. And he's also done some really interesting real-life stuff before we lost him to the groves of academe for a doctorate. And then he went on to work for a four-letter government institution. Let's start here. I want to really keep this practical. So I'm going to take kind of the memes and the tropes online, and I'm going to put them with the media headlines. And I'm just going to use practical examples, and then you're going to explain to me the economics underneath it. Does that all make sense? Clear as mud?
Sure thing. Let's have fun.
All right. Let's start with working wages, living wages, all that sort of thing. I will give you a real-world example. When I first got my first W-2 job, because I've worked way before that, I was working at Walmart. I was unloading trucks. Minimum wage was $5.15 an hour at the time. I got the bump to $5.35 because I was working swing shift. Fast forward 20-odd years, my daughter is working across the parking lot at a different establishment in the service sector, started out $17 an hour. So people go, well, prices change, inflation's change, wages rise, so on and so forth. What's the economic principle behind that, though? Because people just make that comparison all the time between generations without the actual underlying economic data, and then we apply it to headlines and nobody knows what they're talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, at least when I grew up, which I think was the same time that you grew up, you know, minimum wage was not thought of to provide a living wage, right? The truth is, you know, the jobs, you know, at that point in time that paid a minimum wage were those jobs where it was relatively easy to find people to do the work. Work was relatively uncomplicated, unphysical, you know, very much plug and play. No education really needed. And also ones where they expected significant turnover, right? And so that was, you know, an accepted part of doing business is to have that high turnover. Wages, of course, you know, rise, as you said, with inflation, but also with how the economy changes and whether businesses are having to bid to get workers to come work for them, right? We, as workers, we want businesses to be strapped for needing for people and therefore have to bid up the wage in order to attract us over, right? That's same thing happens in football, right? You know, two teams are competing for one player that they both really want. What do? They bid up the size of the contract, right? So if you happen to have a skill set that gets in demand, right, you can benefit from that. You know, one of the things that we saw during the COVID economy, to go back, is we actually saw for the first time in a long time that the wages at the lower end of the scale were rising significantly faster than the wages at the top end of the scale. For a long time, we have seen the returns to work increase sizably for the for the what I would call higher skill, which I do not like that term, but it is used by economists. But that reflects more of the highly educated. Maybe that's what I'll use, because I think that's a better term. To the highly educated, to the capital owners, right? And but during COVID, because there was a lot of demand for folks in these sort of service sector positions, wages for their labor went up significantly, which was a good thing. But for the last 30 or 40 years, generally, wages have not kept up with inflation. They have not kept up with standard of living. So that makes it hard, some would say, to exist on, you know, two families earning minimum wage. So then the idea of a living wage comes in. So that's a wage that, you know, if you look at the basket of goods that someone can purchase to live, so small house or, you know, renting a room, you know, enough to pay for food and the very bare bones basics, right? The living wage is an estimate. There's all sorts of estimates for that, but it might be upwards of like $20, $25, depending on what state you're in, right? Minimum wage is much lower. So one of my tropes that I have about the minimum wage in general, right, is that I think it's a football played with both sides. The reason why minimum wage is never kept up, one, it was never intended to be a living wage. Two, it's nowhere close to even being a binding wage on most Americans, the vast majority, like nearly all of them, because the minimum wage is such that it's actually set below the market clearing wage. So it basically has no effects. So if you raise the minimum wage a little bit, it's not changing the grand landscape of employment too much. You might see some localized effects. Certainly some old studies back in the 90s saw that, but that might not be as true today. So that's sort of like my general roundup on what's going on with this. So we can't conflate that the minimum wage is supposed to support a family. The benchmark for that is a living wage. And so then you're comparing the two to say, wow, the, you know, if you're earning minimum wage, then you're not able to take care of a family. And for a lot of reasons that is true. Some of the folks that might earn minimum wage might've been like you and I, right? We started off, you know, 15, 16. My first job, Andrew, if I don't have told you this, I was a janitor at McDonald's. I was earning minimum wage, right? I was not trying to support myself. I was trying to earn some summer cash. You might have retirees, folks that only be in the part-time, want a lot of flexibility. Their partner is earning. So, you know, I think we should get off on the tangent of what is the minimum wage good or bad? Is it providing a living wage? Clearly not. It's more of, you know, where are we going as a society with the advent, I would say, of what's going to happen to a lot of these jobs when the technology changes and we face up to the reality that AI is going to come in a little bit, because it's going to have an impact on a lot of pieces of the labor force.
Funny you bring that up, because the door greeter at the Walmart I worked with had worked there for nearly 30 years. She had worked away and then had moved back to my hometown when they opened the first Walmart. Because she had been there through the stock splits and had done the stock stuff, she was technically on paper a multimillionaire. She had, beautiful. But it was just because of the stock splits of the 80s and 90s. Because for you young kids, Walmart 30, 40 years ago is what Amazon is now. It was exponentially growing. If you had stock in the late 70s of Walmart by the 90s, you were a very happy person. Let's stay on
lucky too, because there are plenty of firms that she could have wound up working for aren't really with us anymore.
And Mr. Sam was actually pretty progressive when it came to things like stock options to his employees and things like that. Read the books on Mr. Sam, the guy that founded Walmart. Fascinating dude. Let me throw you another one, because people talk about, well, the dollar isn't worth what it used to be. Well, that's kind of true in some ways and kind of others. If you look at what's called the DXY index, and I'll let you explain that. If you go back to the late 70s, which everybody agrees was pretty dismal economic times, right? Through today, there's actually a bit of a circadian rhythm to the dollar cycles. It goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. For example, late 70s up through 81, we know there was equities undervalued. Then it goes up. Then it goes down in the early 90s. Then you have the tech bubble. It goes back up. Then it goes back down after that, 2008, 2009. You have another thing of equities being undervalued because we came out of a recession period. Now it's gone back up to the new tech bubble and AI and all that. And now we have tariffs and things like that. There's actually a bit of a circadian rhythm to this thing that just trucks along. You're an economist. You explain to folks that like ups and downs in and of themselves are not bad. The news cycle covers them as bad, but this is actually kind of par for the course on how it's going. And if you start screwing with that circadian rhythm, a lot of times you wind up a lot worse off than you started.
Yeah, you're trying to stop something that's a natural market impulse, right? And it's trying to pull itself back. Think of it as reversion to the mean, right? So let's take a wide view. And I think, Andrew, that's a great, I'm glad you pointed out DXY, which is just an index of sort of the dollar sort of purchasing power. Back in 1988, the value of the dollar is on par, purchasing wise, with the value today, which is kind of weird. You might think that that index is not quite right. I mean, it's accounting for inflation, those other things. So these things do range, right? They go up and they go down, and they largely go up and they go down for things that are well outside of our control, right? They go up and down based on what's happening in other countries, the demand for our products, their products, what's happening in our economy, right? We went through a period where manufacturing was leaving America, right? There was a point where businesses, it was cost effective for them to move production overseas. Now we're in an environment, not just the US, but other countries too, where there's more of a, they're wanting to move back because of supply chain risks and interruption risks that are now sort of out there that weren't really present back in the day, right? There's also risks of what happens when you offshore your industrial capacity. Like, I'll do an example because everyone loves to rag on Elon right now. Tesla opened up a factory in China for the what was at the time cheap labor and cheap facilities. The biggest electric car maker today that's getting all the press is BYD, a Chinese electric car maker. It's very interesting to note that, you know, they were able to start producing electric cars faster, cheaper, easier. After Tesla, it is probably the case that there was a little bit of industrial espionage going there, right? Or just what we see with companies all the time, like with OpenAI and Facebook, right? Pilfering talent that knows how the other business worked and bringing those good ideas they had for that business into the new business, right?
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And let's do another one while we're on this topic, because I think the idea that these things have kind of a lifespan of their own. Let's talk about mortgage versus rent. This is one I see online a lot. Urbanists and the data geeks and people that are into urban planning and housing debates, and I know you're big into the housing debates, rent versus mortgage is always kind of woven through that, right? It's something that always gets discussed. If we look at the charts from July 09 to January now, give or take, the gap between those two on the chart going across, and I know this makes for horrible podcasting. If you're watching on the video, we'll put the chart up in the links. The gap between those two has been pretty steady, though. So even though rent goes up, mortgages go up, the gap between the two has been very, very steady over the years. Things, you know, they use what they call the 25% mortgages, which, you know, layman's term, that's a healthy mortgage, is 25% of your overall income, blah, 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 blah. That's the stat they try to look at. So healthy people doing healthy financial decisions with mortgages and their rent, for all the talk about it, and it goes up and down, it's actually been pretty steady, that gap, over the last 15 years or so. But we don't talk about it that way.
Well, part of the reason why it's steady is also there's been no improvement in it. Right, I think that's important because we have had a fairly chronic long-term housing shortage in this country across the board, not saying in a particular city there's a housing shortage. When we talk about units that people would like to buy but they can't, there's been a fairly consistent gap over the last, you know, two decades. That gap got exacerbated just recently due to COVID and how the economy came out of that. But these sort of persistent things, like we have all these bills that go in that are going to fix the housing economy. They never really seem to fix the housing economy. You know, they fix something that might have been a problem for 20 years ago, but they don't, that was resolved somehow, some way. And they don't really change the dynamic going forward, right? So we're seeing a lot of scuttlebutt in the Senate Finance Committee about new housing bills that will unlock the American dream. Well, I hate to say it like this, but interest rates are high right now for lots of folks. The property values are high right now. A lot of the homes that have been built are not starter homes. Like, this part of our housing gap, there's the idea of a missing middle, which is somewhat controversial, but it just, that represents just like, you're not building like apartments and you're not building like mega mansions, right? You know, you are building apartments or you're building mega mansions. You're not really building the 1,000-foot Rambler anymore, you know, or the 1,200-square-foot split level, you know, or something like that. And so those are the homes that aren't being built that might be a way to change the housing dynamic and make the housing market work a bit better. We're not seeing that. And so, like, we're continuing to see the same problem in the housing market, despite changes that happen overall to some legislation that takes care of some edge cases.
Yeah, and
sorry
just
for being
to dig
a pessimist.
No, but I know you do a lot with housing, so I want to dig down on this for just a second, though, because we talked about that 25% mortgage. That's a healthy mortgage for renters. The data point uses usually 30% of your income going
30%.
To rent.
Yep.
So the 25%ers and the 30%ers for rent and mortgage. Let's start with the rent one, because comparatively speaking, rent is really high now because there's a lot of people that need more than 30% to make their rent. It goes to the construction and those things. It also varies greatly depending on your municipalities, because obviously New York and San Francisco has a lot more demand than, you know, pick your average other city that you want to pick. I'm not going to pick anybody off here. There's reasons for this. But the political answer to all those is very multifaceted, and we don't want to talk about that in the media because there's not a one-solve-fix-everything issue when it comes to housing. It's multi-layered systemic stuff, and if you pull one Jenga piece out, it affects another Jenga piece. So while we bash on people rightly for not dealing with housing policy, it's also one of the most complicated economic things we have, which also makes it very politically fraught. Can we have honest conversation that, yeah, we bang on it, but it's also really, really hard to do right?
Well, the solution, I like you brought this up, because the solution is at the federal, the state, and the local level, right? The federal government can do things to incentivize housing construction. It can give tax breaks, things like that, that'll motivate producers to build housing. It can, you know, at the margins, free up land, though I don't think that, you know, freeing up, you know, land that's, you know, in the middle of nowhere is going to do much for housing prices in Boise, Idaho, let alone New York City. But, you know, let's acknowledge that there is a role to help incentivize, you know, housing solutions at the federal level. There's also education. There's also support that we could have. But there's also a role at the state level to determine how they want to grow and the requirements they might put in for where houses can be built and the governing restrictions on those homes, right? Florida is going to have different rules for the construction of their homes, given their natural risks, than Texas, than California, than Minnesota, right? Makes sense there. And then you have the third layer, which is the local politics, right? Where the residents are, where that is, and that's probably the most sticking point, because that's where we're the most human, right? Where we see that this new thing is being built, right? And that might change the character of my neighborhood within a 3-block radius. And I care deeply about my neighborhood being like the neighborhood that I moved in, you know? And so that is a friction that is not inherent to a political party. It is a friction that is at the local level that brings Otherwise, very different people together to be like, we don't like this change. You know, and it can, you know, like, for example, in my local neighborhood, which we're all people are pro-housing, right, supposedly, we have a old government building. It's not being used, old city building. And they wanted, they had some developers interested in transforming it from a two-story building to a three-story building, you know, with sort of like some faux, you know, duplex, you know, fronts and things like that. So it would look like the character of the neighborhood and things like that. But people were like, this will change the dynamic of our neighborhood. And we don't like thinking that there's going to be 50 more people in this area. So there was a big pushback against that from the very same people that have the everyone is welcome here sign, right? And that creates frictions in the neighborhood to you know, get the housing that the neighborhood needs, that the neighborhood businesses need, the local community needs to be able to continue to thrive. So it is a highly, you're right, it's a highly complex problem with a highly complex solution. And I think one thing that you and I definitely agree on is that the way our political landscape is in this country at the state, local, and national level is that acknowledging the complexity is not a way to get reelected. It is simple as a simple does. The Forrest Gump electorate.
Yeah, and let's blow up another talk radio, online, Twitter, and a whole lot of campaign ads that are going to be going into the midterm elections for the next year and 3 or 4 months, whatever it is. All right, Mr. Economist, PhD person, super smart dude. Inflation and high prices can be similar, can be causation and all that good stuff. They do not automatically mean the same thing. Please explain and give two examples. Because everybody is just using, oh, high prices, that's inflation. Well, no, they go together, but those are not the same thing, because when we go out of this cycle of inflation, people are going to get real confused, like, well, wait a minute, inflation's down, why aren't the prices down? Or prices are up, why isn't inflation up? Can you go through this real quick? Because this is systemic. Everybody's doing it. People that know better are doing it. You're seeing people on TV that you know better are doing it. Inflation and high prices are not the same, but we have both inflation and high prices. Dr. Pavic, please explain.
So inflation is a general increase in the price level, right? I think the challenge that you're reflecting here is when folks say, well, housing is expensive. Well, that's not necessarily due to just inflation in housing. That's due to other factors that are creating that high price. High demand, low supply. Classic economics that actually works, that raises prices. That's not inflation in the way that we economists would think about inflation generally. Inflation generally would be, you know, a rise in the price level that's sort of not really, you know, adherent to sort of individual, but specific factors going in. And so, you know, you can have, you know, home prices rising, and that is not necessarily inflation. The other thing is, you know, we also talk about what is the real price, right? So we can sort of separate out what is the real wage, you know, what is the wage as it changes with respect to inflation. So let's net out. So you can see, sometimes these things where you take the simple thing is take the wage and you say, let's net out the inflationary aspect of the wage. Okay. So now we've done that. So now we have the real wage. But the real wage for different workers of different types, right? That fluctuates based on market demand and supply for those workers and competing interests from other countries and from other sectors and industries, right? So I hope that makes sense. Like things can rise, you can have inflation is a general phenomena and price increases can be very specific to the product or the type of labor, which is a wage is a price of labor, right? To something that's sort of a non general localized effect.
All right, I'm going to throw one of my current economic theories at me. You can tell me if I'm on base or off base, because I've been hammering this one a lot. I think it's sound, but I, you know, friends hold friends accountable. I'm going to give you a shot at me here if I'm wrong. I think bad economic policy is the second worst thing you can possibly do. I think the worst possible economic thing you can do is have uncertainty, because everybody can adjust to a bad policy. You can't adjust to uncertainty. I think that's some of what we're seeing. This applies to not only people or corporations, it also applies to countries. It applies to organizations like the EU and things like this. So does my statement hold up there if we were going to challenge it in an academic setting, that uncertainty is worse than bad policy?
So let me ask you a question. When you're trying to take your kids out to a restaurant, they can't agree on a restaurant to go to. Does that cause more strife than just saying we're going to the so-so Mexican place and just eating there?
Strife? Yes, that causes some disconcertment. That's see, here's my thing is I've had enough children that when we go out to eat, there's a brief period where we discuss it. And then there's what I call the actionable period, where we're going to do it. And if you don't like it, that's your problem, because we're not going to have strife while we actually eat. So there's some stages to that, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Like an economy, there's stages to it.
Yeah. I think in my example, though, yeah, so I would agree with you that uncertainty is a first order problem for an economy. Even if you have a bad policy, businesses can plan on that bad policy being known, and they can make adjustments, and they can make future plans and forecasts, and they can make decisions on where to get their inputs in. They can make decisions on who to hire, how many people to hire, what to pay them. When you have an economy where things seem to change at the minute and the second, significantly so, that really does cause businesses and planners difficulty in making decisions that, you know, will change production and change supply in the next quarter. So it is basically like adding an anvil to your speedboat. Your speedboat might still go somewhat fast, but it's going to sit down lower in the water, and you're going to get splashed a bit more.
And you mean add an anvil in the Wile E. Coyote sense, where it's going to go through the floor of it?
Depends. But yes, it could go through the floor. And, you know, I'm just saying, you're not going to have as good of a time out there in your speedboat if you got an anvil in it, you know?
Yeah. All right. Economic trope. Good way to kind of wrap up this little conversation. I hear this one a lot. I know it's not true, but here's the thing. You spend a lot of time as an economist going through data. You spend a lifetime kind of studying trends on things like this. Let me throw you one that I see a lot of, and it really gets my goat, because it's a gross generalization that basically means nothing except what the person saying it's trying to make it mean. How often do we hear, well, these days just nobody wants to work? That's the thing that gets thrown out. Well, the real problem with the economy is nobody wants to work. Now, I've actually studied this one a little bit. I've seen the data, but from your lofted perch with your credentials and what such, when you hear something like that, is that matching the data? Is that matching the policy? And does that match reality?
I think folks have, just from my personal perspective, folks have a need to belong and a need to do something constructive, right? Something to believe in. For some people, that may be making motorcycles. For some people, that may mean, you know, being a gun safety officer at a range, right? That may, for other people, that may be teaching, right? People want to do something. Like, it's just in our nature, it's innate. The question is the value that we placed on that labor and the price we're willing to pay it enough to get people to do the job? That is why when you have jobs that are, say, more dangerous, maybe you're a coal worker back in the day, you got paid a premium because they knew it was dangerous. You know, if you are a nurse in an ICU and you take up the overnight shift, well, that's harder, so you get paid a premium. But when businesses are not offering, right, the wage that folks would say they need to do that job, then that's what creates employment. That might create the, well, people aren't willing to do this. Well, I would say to those folks and say, well, some people just don't want to work here, work anymore. You know, our attitudes and beliefs around work and around family and around social life change every generation. And perhaps what we're seeing is sort of what a generation has decided is what is valued to them, right? I think we've gone to a point where, you know, we've probably overvalued work in this country in the sense of, we're overvalued work in the sense that we are a country of workaholics. People are putting in a lot of hours and doing work where they don't necessarily need to, and they're sacrificing, say, time with family, time with friends, time with their children. Other countries, very similar to us, maybe different politics, maybe the same politics, make very different choices on how they distribute their time. Right. So I believe that what we're seeing when people say people don't want to work anymore is they're taking values and judgments they had from their generation and applying it to new generations that have built upon the knowledge that those past generations have had and looked at the choices that they've made and seen how they worked out. So I think it's incorrect to state that people don't want to work. I think it's people don't want to work for the price you're willing to pay them because of other things that they value.
I think this is why you're seeing the gig economy, and some estimates think it'll be as many as half of all workers by 2027. And those estimates always change, but I know it's a lot. But I think this is why you see the gig economy thing, because I think a lot of people are finding like either my side hustle will be my passion, and that's what I really like, and I do my day job to support my passion. Or people are just making the determination like, I like the work-life balance of owning 90 to 100% of what I'm doing instead of owning 10 to 20 with a 40-year traditional career for a company. And I think that there's a cultural part of that that you have to talk about separately. But I think economically, that's the calculus a lot of people are making of, hey, with the technology, I can work a little less, do something I really care on the side, and it's going to measure out in what is proportionally acceptable to me lifestyle and economy-wise. And we don't talk about that in a way.
And the amount of money that you earn is not necessarily the value of your life, right? If you enjoy what you do and you can make your ends meet, you might be richer than someone that's making $3 million a year.
So very, very happy rich people. I know miserable people. I know really miserable poor people. And I know really happy poor people. You know what they all have in common? Whether they're happy or not happy. And it really didn't matter about their bank account. Now, it's easier to be happy when you're rich. Let's not pretend, you know, when you got money, you can buy a lot of happiness, but it doesn't make you happy, right?
That is correct. Yeah. So, I mean, I think in part, like, we just need to be aware that the choices that people are making, like, we don't have all the information that other folks have specific to their circumstances. And so for us to put our value judgment on, are they making a good decision or not, sort of smacks to me of some ignorance and some arrogance on our part, where we think that we know what's going on in them. Like, that is why I get upset when, you know, I was upset with, you know, some folks that overvalue the value of a college degree and didn't value the value of a vocational degree, right? Or that sort of training, or people that would say, oh, you need to do something more than you know, working on a rural farm or something like that. Well, you know, maybe they don't value the big city, getting on a bus and spending 2 hours commuting to work every day. Maybe they actually value this thing more, and they're okay not having some of these creature comforts. Like, these are choices that people should be making. And the thing that government should be doing, in my opinion, is giving people accurate information to help them make those choices based on their own personal, like, attributes and characteristics.
Yeah, and let's not forget things like COVID tell people exactly what their government and their jobs thought of them under pressure. And a lot of them just believed what they were told by their government and their jobs, what they thought of them, and they've adjusted accordingly. And I think that's something
Andrew, that was also a shock to where people all of a sudden had to do things differently for a bit. And that also forces introspection and learning and thinking that might change your sort of value functions in life, right?
Yep. I agree. Stephen Popick, outstanding stuff as always. I like talking economics this way because you get into the figures and the graphs and the stats and everybody's eyes kind of roll over. I like talking about it in a practical way like that. And you make it so easy that even I could understand it. Let folks know where they can keep up with you till we get you back, buddy.
Well, you can keep up with me on this lovely podcast here. I occasionally post on Blue Sky under Motoconomist. I'm just hanging out. Although I will say this much, Andrew, I don't think I'm watching WWE for a long time now.
I think they heard him. He's got a background in pro wrestling. We will bring that up at a latter date because we already shot our wad on the Hulk Hogan stuff. So I can't talk wrestling for another week or two just for the normies. Buddy, I appreciate you. Thank you for your time, sir.
No problem.
All right.
All the music on Her Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.